Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Imagine conducting a science experiment on a new drug, say for nausea in pregnancy, where the test subjects are all 35-year-old white women in the same small town in Wisconsin with similar husbands and IQs that are the same. That would be recognized as a terrible experiment because we wouldn't know if the drug had broader applicability to others. But that's how we conduct mouse research and likely why we have such a high failure rate in biomedical science. That's me paraphrasing one of the scientists interviewed by my guest today, NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, in his new book, Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. Harris is a longtime correspondent at NPR, starting at the network in 1986. He's reported from all seven continents and won numerous awards for his reporting. Harris is also a past president of the National Association of Science Writers. In early 2014, his focus shifted from an emphasis on climate change and the environment to biomedical research, work that led him to explore the biomedical science industry and the lack of consistency and reproducibility of many studies, which became the basis for Rigor Mortis. Richard Harris of NPR's Science Desk is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Richard Harris, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to start by just asking you about your book, Rigor Mortis, because it left me feeling less than hopeful about the state of our medical science. And I guess one way we could start is by just talking about what you found, I think, which, if I understood correctly, is kind of what led you to write the book, the lack of reproducibility of many of our scientific studies. Tell us what you found.
Yes, I've had a lot of problems along those lines, and for multiple reasons. I mean, first of all, science is hard, right? Even under the best of circumstances, you're dealing with biological systems that are unpredictable and hard to deal with. So to start off with, I feel a lot of sympathy for the scientists who are trying to do this work. But I also found a lot of examples of scientists who were doing things that were not helping them at all. In fact, were hurting their results. And they were using poorly thought about ingredients. They weren't what they thought they were. They were using methods that were really not the appropriate methods. They were using statistics, the analysis to figure out what's really going on, that were also not the right statistics for those circumstances. And to top it all off, you know, the pressures of the biomedical world, unfortunately, push people to cut corners and to make these shortcuts that really are not helpful for getting the best possible science out. Unfortunately, scientists kind of feel like they have to either choose between doing what's best for their career or doing the best science. And unfortunately, those two things don't line up as well as we would hope.
Yeah, so give us an example, if you can, of what there was a couple of different studies, essentially, that did sort of the same process of trying. And what I guess what was surprising to me as a reader and as someone who works in medicine, thinking, you know, that something that does get published in a medical journal has gone through peer review and is fairly rigorous in its methodology, was that something that I may take as near gospel in terms of a therapy or a treatment may not actually, even in a after having been through a large clinical trial, let alone the more preliminary animal studies, may not be reproducible at all.
Right. And I think these problems are clearly most substantial in the preclinical trials. These are experiments with cells or mice or other animals in the laboratory. By the time something gets to be a drug, normally it has jumped through quite a number of other hoops. And sometimes drugs get pulled off the market because it turns out that they don't work or they may even be harmful. But that's a much less common problem than what I really focus on in my book. And that's the scientists who are working in the labs and trying to find leads for new drugs, new treatments, and to understand disease. And it turns out that very often those studies that get published in the literature don't stand the test of time. And I started off early in my reporting on this, I started to realize that how big an issue this was when I read an article in the journal Nature where a scientist named Glenn Begley, who was at the drug company Amgen, decided to go back and look at a bunch of studies that had been done that had come across as trans, and they'd been done at university laboratories. And he decided, you know, if these studies turn out to be true, these are leads for great possible drugs. And so he set out to try to replicate them. And he ultimately looked at 53 different studies, and he couldn't get very many of them to reproduce at all. And in fact, he even took some of them back to the original scientists who did the studies and said, I'm having trouble with this. Could you do it in your lab and show me? And very often he said, in those circumstances, the studies could not be reproduced. In the end of these 53, only 6 of them were able to be reproduced. So that's, 11%? That's a really pretty low success rate. And there was a second study similar to that was done by drug company scientists at the Bayer drug company in Germany, and they found that they could get only about 25% of their studies to reproduce. So this is a pretty discouraging figure if you're looking to the output of university research scientists to say, okay, is this the road to the next new drug? And the answer is frequently, no, it's actually a dead end.
And another really interesting thing your book taught me was a little bit about the animal research. And so, for example, we're highly dependent, I think, in the research world on mice for a number of reasons, hopefully that I'll let you explain. But one thing that surprised me was that it's not maybe a big surprise, but mice and humans turn out not to be so similar in how we respond to various chemicals and substances. And so often we make what seem like giant inferences. When something seems responsive in the mouse model, we get excited, or the stockholders or investors get, this is going to be the next breakthrough drug for ALS or Parkinson's or what have you, only to be disappointed time and again. But rats and mice, it seems like, only have concordance, I think you reported in the book, 60% of the time in drug toxicity trials. That was surprising to me, because I guess I think of rats and mice as fairly similar.
Yeah, you would think so. And that's for a certain kind of toxicity test to see if a drug causes some unwanted effect in the mouse, does it in the rat? And as you say, about 60% of the time it does, and the other 40% of the time it doesn't. So that's pretty surprising and is a valuable lesson for us. I think the other really curious story I came across in sort of thinking about how good animals are as stand-ins for people was the story about how these drugs called statins got developed. And statins are these incredibly popular drugs that are used to control cholesterol in the blood, right? And they are just, it's a multi-billion-dollar market, et cetera, et cetera. And it turns out back in the days when they were trying to develop these drugs, they had done some basic laboratory research and said, oh, here's an interesting biological pathway that if we could find a way to interfere with it, this might really help control blood cholesterol. And they took these drugs that they were the earliest statins, and they tried them in mice, and they didn't work. And then they tried them in rats, and they didn't work in rats either. And in fact, at that point, one of the drug companies developing these drugs decided, this is a dead end, we're giving up on it. But there was a scientist in Japan who said, I'm not quite ready to give up on this because I really believe that there's something here. And he went down the hall, and one of his colleagues was actually using, instead of rats and mice, he was using chickens to do some basic laboratory research. And this Japanese scientist said, hey, do you mind if I try this new drug on your chickens? And lo and behold, the drug really worked, and that's how statins came about. And you'd think, well, if it's not going to work in a mouse, why would it possibly work in a chicken, which is, of course, much more distantly related to us than mice? But the lesson here is not to put too much faith in that analogy that because we're mammals and mice are mammals, that what works in a mouse works in a human is often not the case.
Yeah, and why you explain this pretty well. Why do scientists rely on mice so much?
Well, mice are very handy to deal with. They reproduce rapidly. You can keep them in little cages. There's an entire industry that's built up around the care and feeding of mice. And if you're working in a particular field where everybody uses mice, well, of course you're going to use mice. Because if you say, well, I'm going to use emus or some other random animal, you probably have trouble getting your papers published. Even if it's a really good model, scientists might say, well, gee, we're not used to thinking about studying this other weird animal, so we're going to give you grief. So there's sort of a pressure just to use mice because everybody else in the field uses mice. And they're, genetically bred with great care and precision. They are genetically manipulated. Their genes are edited and so on. And so there's a whole lot of very sophisticated technology that goes on to make these mouse models. The problem is knowing how much to believe them when all is said and done.
Yeah, and you paint sort of this, I think, kind of horrifying picture, say, of the Stanford Biomedical Research Facility where it's underground and it's this floor-to-ceiling set of mouse cages. And something that was really surprising to me was even though they're using these purchased mice that are all sort of genetically identical, there's differences in responses in how essentially what the scientists attributed it to was how much stress the mice feel, whether they're closer to the light, that is closer to the ceiling, or down by the floor where they feel less stress. So even in a very controlled environment like that, there's a tremendous amount of variability, even in these mice that purportedly are all the same.
Right. And actually, it was not an unpleasant place to be. I mean, it was like being in the world's largest pet store, I guess you'd say, because the mice were all in these plastic cages. And it was, it was clean and all the rest of it. But it is true that the variations between cages mattered a lot. The fact is, they are actually the temperature set wrong for mice. They are uncomfortably cold for where they would rather be. And there's lots of factors that make this a less than ideal circumstance. They also try very hard to keep germs out, which is quite understandable. You don't want to have diseases sweeping through your mice. But on the other hand, it means that the mouse immune system is not fully developed because it hasn't been exposed to all of these things that, that we pick up along the way, and that's how we train our immune system. So if you're trying to use these mice to study diseases or, you know, how the immune system works, it's probably not a very realistic way to do that.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Richard Harris. He's an NPR science correspondent, and he's author of the new book, Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. And one thing that also surprised me, and I mean pretty much everything in the book was surprising in sort of a disappointing way about just how hard science is and I guess the difficulty that's there. But I was pretty much under the impression that scientists were very good at identifying various cell types and tissues. If you took a kind of a cell, let's just say, and showed it to a pathologist and said, all right, what organ does this come from or what kind of cell is this? You know, I would have bet before I read your book that they'd be pretty good at saying, oh, this is a liver cell or, oh, this is a bone marrow cell. But it turns out it's not nearly as simple as we think.
It's not. And I'll tell you a short story about that. One of the cells that I feature in my book is called MDA-MB435. And this is a cell line that was a cancer cell line that was extracted from a woman in Houston in 1976 who had breast cancer. And they were able to grow it in the lab. And scientists were very excited about having a breast cancer cell that they could grow easily in the lab, because then they could study breast cancer basically in little jars as opposed to in human beings or in animals. And it's a nice tool for studying breast cancer. And it was used very widely. In fact, it ended up on the list of the National Cancer Institute's 60 most important cancer cell lines to study. And this was in the mid-70s. It was isolated. And back then, it was really actually not that easy to identify what a particular cell was. But by 1999, 2000, there were some of these genetic tests that we now take for granted were really developed for the first time. And some scientists at Stanford said, let's take all of these NCI-60 cells and test them out and see what they really are. And so they ran these genetic tests to see which genes would be turned on and turned off in various cancers. And sure enough, all of the lung cancer cells had a common set of genes that were either turned on or turned off, and all of the liver cancers had a set of genes that looked a lot alike. And they got to the breast cancers, and most of the breast cancers looked the same, except for this one, which turned out to look exactly like a melanoma cell line. And they realized this is probably a contaminant that had crept into the lab long ago, probably for decades. And nobody had realized that all these years, scientists thinking they were studying breast cancer were actually studying a melanoma cancer cell. And the National Cancer Institute put a little note on the website where people study these cells and said, please be aware this, MDA-MB435, although labeled as a breast cancer, is apparently a melanoma, so use with care. But even so, I looked in the medical literature, and since then, there have been over 900 studies that refer to this as a breast cancer cell. In fact, I looked just last week, and there was another study that had just been published saying breast cancer cell, blah, 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 even though it was actually pretty well established as it's actually a melanoma. So there is a really easy test these days, a genetic fingerprint. Essentially, you can send a cell off and have it checked and see what, in fact, it is. And scientists are now supposed to do that with their cells if they're getting funding from the National Institutes of Health. But it's not clear exactly how well people are complying with that new requirement. And it's clear that there are hundreds of cell lines, actually, that are imposters like this, that are misidentified and have been used throughout the many years. Obviously aren't what they thought they are. And as you alluded to in your question, some of these are even animal cell lines that are, non-human animal cell lines that are labeled as humans.
Yeah, it was just astonishing. I mean, just so shocking to think that. And yet the industry, just the science industry, as it were, persists. And as you point out, it's important for the careers of scientists and researchers just to continue on in the publication and grant-finding cascade because the incentives are there to just get the work done, as it were, and sort of let the consequences fall. And it's not done, obviously, maliciously. Not most of the time, I should say, it's not.
Right, that's true. In fact, as far as I can tell, deliberate fraud or deliberately misleading people is a very rare occurrence in science. The problem is that, people, there's so many ways to get things wrong, and scientists aren't necessarily taking all the care they need to say, have I really checked my cell lines? Have I really used the right number of animals in my study to make sure that the results I get are going to be meaningful and not misleading? Am I using the right statistical test once I actually have my results? Or am I, noodling around and finding things that are answers to questions I hadn't asked, which is also a very common problem that leads to misleading results? Because if it wasn't your original question and you see something else in your data, you need to be very careful about coming to the conclusion that that's a real finding. It could very easily be a statistical fluke, and it very often is.
Yeah, and that was something else you highlighted that I thought was really surprising, that here are scientists, you know, well-trained in biology or molecular biology, cell biology, and yet not so strong in statistical sciences, as it were. And then when you're thinking about, or what I also learned was that in using animal models for these types of things, the studies aren't set up to, you know, essentially test an adequate number of subjects most of the time, it seems like.
Or frequently, for sure. And one of those stories involves ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, which is this terrible disease where people, basically, their muscles, they gradually lose control of their muscles, and it's a fatal disease. And people have tried for many years to find a drug that would be successful for treating those. And they've been using, heavily relying on an animal model, a mouse model, to try to identify promising candidates. And these mouse models have, these tests in mice have said, oh, here's a promising candidate. This one looks like this is doing something in our mice, and so on. And many of those have been tried in large numbers of people and have failed. And what's going on there is basically some scientists went back and said, why are all these seemingly promising results in mice failing? And they went back and they redid, well, first of all, they looked at the original studies and they noticed that very often they involved a very small number of mice, and so you easily get a result that is not very robust if you don't use enough mice. They weren't paying attention to whether, you know, they had male or female mice in the studies, or whether they had littermates, brothers and sister mice, in one group, and or whether they were divided up, or all these other sorts of things you need to do to make sure that you really have a good random sample you're working with. And when the scientists at an institute called the ALS Therapy Development Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, went back to redo these studies with enough mice and you know, carefully designed and looking at the genetics and the sex and everything else that they needed to, they discovered that essentially none of these drugs looked promising if you did the mouse studies correctly. And it's a pretty discouraging finding. And there's also, it's not just because scientists are sloppy, but these experiments are incredibly expensive. When the ALS Therapy Development Institute does them, they cost over $100,000 for every drug or every dose. And if you're getting an NIH grant, you don't have that kind of money to spend doing a mouse study. And so you do a much smaller study, and I guess you just cross your fingers. You say it's a pilot study, and you hope that it's going to pan out. But as we see, very often those things don't pan out.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Richard Harris. He's a science correspondent for NPR, and his new book is called Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. And Richard, we talked a little bit, we touched on fraud in science, and you cover a little bit in the book a couple of fellows. One is named Ivan Aransky, and I think his partner Adam Marcus. They write a blog that they started a few years ago called Retraction Watch. And what did you report on those guys?
Well, they are journalists, and Ivan's a physician. I'm actually not sure about Adam, but they decided that they really wanted to look at retractions as a way of understanding sort of where science is failing. And retractions are when a paper is published and it turns out to be wrong, the scientists will say, we made a mistake and we'd like to retract our paper. Or more often, somebody else will call them on it and say, you've done something wrong, you've switched image, you know, your images are wrong, or your analysis is wrong. And sometimes it's a pretty contentious battle to get something retracted, because it harms your career if you actually end up with a retraction that's considered a black mark. So, but it is also a really good window into the ways that science can fail. And so Retraction Watch, which is publicly available on the web, is sort of an interesting window into this whole issue. And when Adam and Ivan started out to do this, they thought, oh, this will sort of be a curious sidelight. There didn't seem to be that many retractions. But they quickly discovered, as they started nosing around, that there were tons of retractions, or hundreds, I should say. And it's become a full-time enterprise just to catalog them and explain them. And they call up, or they have a little staff now, and they call up the scientists and say, can you explain what went wrong there? And sometimes scientists will talk, and sometimes they'll not. And sometimes lawyers will threaten them, and sometimes scientists even sue their universities over retractions, saying, you're harming my career by insisting that my work be retracted, and so on. So it's, as I say, it's sort of a fringe of this whole enterprise, because most of the errors that crop up in science certainly do not rise to this level. They are many of the retractions turn out to be things that are dubious and not entirely innocent errors sometimes. And on the spectrum, this is pretty far over on one side of really, you know, often bad behavior. A lot of the time, it's the behavior's not deliberately bad. It's just the phrase that some scientists have used is they call these are detrimental research practices, which are not outright fraud, but they're just not helpful. And, you know, it's cutting corners. It's not doing one more experiment that you really should have done or those sorts of things.
Well, one other character who recurs in the book frequently is a guy named John Ioannidis out, I think, at Stanford now. And tell us why he's such an interesting character in this big industry of science. He's sort of a scientist himself, but also kind of a critic. He's a sort of a scientist of the science.
He absolutely is. And he started out really looking at what was wrong with clinical medicine, the studies that led to drugs and treatments and so on back in the 1990s. And there were these kinds of problems I've been describing in preclinical research were actually more common back then also in the studies that led to, you know, drug development or big claims about what vitamins are good for you and thus and such. And so he started out his career digging into those kinds of studies and identifying errors with them and publishing. Really, his career was publishing what's wrong with the literature. And one of his most famous papers, or his most famous paper actually, is called Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. And this is kind of a statistical argument about why, because so many of these studies are very small, and just by chance, a lot of small studies are going to be incorrect. He basically makes this argument that you should really be very careful when you're diving into the medical literature and looking at any one particular study. The chances of it being right are not that great. And so one thing he believes in is what is called meta-analysis, where you pull together a whole bunch of studies and you say, maybe some of these studies are individually wrong, but when you add them up, how well do they add up? And you learn more looking at a body of research as opposed to a single study. So he's made a very big name for himself in a career, very prolific publisher of papers, as sort of being a critic of what's going on in biomedical research. And he's recently turned his attention to this preclinical research. Sort of, he feels, you know, they've had some significant success in cleaning up the clinical science that the problems that have plagued that field in the 1990s in particular. And now he and a partner named Steve Goodman have started a center at Stanford called Metrics, which is meta research, meaning research about research. And they are trying to really dig into these questions, understand why these problems are cropping up, and looking for ways to solve them. Because, you know, it's once people recognize that these are problems and that they are serious and pervasive, nobody wants to just let this fester, or most people don't. So Ioannidis and Steve Goodman are saying, you know, what can we do? What sorts of simple or not so simple things can we do to change sort of the climate of research and the practice of research to reduce these unforced errors that are pretty prevalent?
Well, one of the upshots of the book reminded me of a guest that we've had on this program frequently, Gary Schweitzer at Health News Review. And it's essentially to sort of calm down the breathlessness of many of the headlines and to take things a little more slowly and not so much as gospel, but our 24-hour news cycle really works against that principle. We're often wanting to believe the latest study that coffee promotes health or chocolate makes you heart healthy, or the next day you find out it kills you. So especially too, one of the things Gary's particularly critical about is when journalists, or I guess PR flacks, as he likes to sometimes call them, will extrapolate from a mouse study to something in a human, and where a press release or a news story that's based on that won't make that disclaimer that, hey, this is only in a small sample, or this is only in an animal model. Let's not get all breathless about it.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the culture of science, that basically there's not enough money to go around, and so scientists know that they have to have big, exciting findings. It helps them to get public attention and to get promotions, to get new grant money. It's part and parcel, unfortunately, of this hyper-competitive world that we're in. The amount of money for biomedical research from the National Institutes of Health has been declining in real spending power over the last decade. It's 20% or more or less than it was in 2003. So, and only recently there have been a couple of upticks. We don't know what the future of this holds, but it could be grim looking forward. But this creates a situation where scientists will have to apply for 5 grants in order to get one. And I talked to some professors who said, I spend most of my time just writing grant proposals to try to keep my lab running and going. And they need to have some some exciting results. They need to, you know, promote what they're doing as a very important thing. And I quote one paper in my book that went back and looked at the rhetoric of the medical journals themselves, not just the press releases, but what was published in the abstracts of the journals. And between 1974 and 2004, there was an incredible increase in the use of words like robust or innovative or novel or unprecedented. These words were pretty rare in the literature, and they became quite common. And this is part of this whole sense that scientists have that I've got to really sell my ideas, and I've got to make seem really exciting what I've produced. Otherwise, you know, I won't get more grants, I won't get promoted, I'll have to close down my lab. And you know, it's a really unfortunate pressure that they confront. And as I say, I'm sympathetic with them. But it's really also quite hard to change a culture like that when it's being driven by financial scarcity and really systemic problems. It's not just, you know, scientists behaving badly at all.
Well, one solution to this problem of the lack of reproducibility in science, maybe the lack of standardization in some ways and how science is conducted, is this idea of open source or open science, I should say, and where investigators will really just share their data very openly right from the get-go, and in a sense it would be more cost-effective too because they could share resources. Why is this idea, you know, either likely or unlikely to catch on?
Well, there certainly are people advocating for that, but when you're in a hyper-competitive environment, you may not want to share your results because it might give your competition a leg up, unfortunately. And scientists have seen that, you know, they're afraid of getting scooped or that, you know, that somebody else will take their ideas and run with them. So there's a natural tendency to say, you know, on the one hand, sure, in principle, science should all be about openness and sharing, but on the other hand, there are pressures not to do that. I think the idea of transparency is a wonderful one. If you can get people to put their data out for other people to look at, also to have them share their computer code, the little program they use to analyze their data, so any other scientist can pick up the program and dump in the data and see if they get the same results. And I think not only does this help feed through the process of science, where if there's a mistake, it gets discovered more rapidly and fewer people spend their time chasing a dead end, but it's also true that I think if scientists know that people are going to have that much exposure, access to their information, they'll be a bit more careful about what they conclude. And I think they'll think twice. They figure, I'd rather find my own mistakes than have somebody else find them for me and embarrass me. So I think that is a powerful solution if we can overcome some of the barriers.
The name of the book is Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. And it's written by my guest today, Richard Harris of NPR Science Desk. Richard, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, John. I enjoyed talking to you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. If you've missed any of our shows, you can always stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.